You know, the reps have to get really comfortable, kind of like redirecting the demand in a way, and not just playing by the rules of the customer, which can be a little counterintuitive, and try to like elevate the problem to something bigger. And that's how you end up going from you sell an app that would answer these two things to like a big platform that answers a massive issue like revenue leak.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Product Marketing Life podcast, the show where we sit down with everyday product marketers to talk life, career, and most importantly, product marketing. I'm Colin Majak, lead PMM at Klassi, and in this episode, I got a chance to sit down with Julien Sauvage. Now, if you don't know Julien, Julien is the GVP of marketing at Clari, and I went into this episode with one main question. What goes into building a category giant like Clari? And so we got a chance to look under the hood at Clari, and we talked about everything from owning a problem to social proof to building a team and a lot more. I really enjoyed my chat with Julien, and I think you will too. Julien, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Good to see you, Colin. Hi, everybody.
We made it happen after months of back and forth. We did it. So I'm very excited to have you on.
Excited to be here. Sorry, I didn't mean to play hard to get.
No, it's all right. It was worth it. Most important question is what did you have for your cup of coffee this morning?
Oh, nice. What did I have? I had a local coffee roaster called Andy Town out in the Richmond and Sunset. You know Andy Town. I had like a single origin from Indonesia. Very fancy, a little pricey, but really good stuff. Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah, they just finished their new build out on that Sunset location, right?
I don't know, man. That's a good question. It's the one I went to is, I think it's kind of new. Yeah, it's kind of new. Okay. It's on like Taraval. Sorry for like the non-SF folks, but yeah, it's on Taraval, not far from the ocean. It's like teeny tiny, but they have the best coffees and
yeah,
good beans and stuff. So
yeah. And it's good. It doesn't hurt that you can peer around the corner and see the ocean from
that's right. Front door. That combination of like getting all the summer fog from SF, you know, the SF weather, right? We have a lot of fog right now. You get all the fog and all like all the almost the mist and all of that stuff and the wind and the sea, and yet you're still like sipping your delicious, like warm and heartwarming and soul warming coffee. Like that combination, I just love that. You're like cold outside and warm inside kind of thing.
Well, yep. Highly recommend Andy Town we have enough tech people who listen to this who will have to travel to SF. So highly recommend Andy Town or Coffee Movement. I was just trying to think back to when you and I met, and I sort of consider it in two parts. One is the first was after I'd gotten laid off and my buddy Ryan, who was working at Clari at the time, just spoke the world of you, which I would say Ryan was in sales. And so I think when someone from sales speaks really well of someone in product marketing, that's just that's extra high praise. And you were just really gracious with your time over some things I was processing. And the second was when we met at the Product Marketing Alliance Summit in SF. Do you happen to remember the first thing that you said to me? I'm going to doubt it, but I'm curious.
Because you remember? Oh my God, that would be a little creepy.
I do. I got locked in my head.
You do? I don't know if you led with like, oh yeah, I heard great things from you about Ryan. I'm sure I would have told you something very like French style, self-deprecating humor. And I would be like, well, don't believe Ryan because he's full of shit. Maybe I said something like that, but I don't know. I don't remember.
Your first utterance was, oh my God, you're tall.
Okay. You are tall and I'm tall too, but you're like next level tall.
You know, on that note of self-deprecating, I'll force you to not self-deprecate for a minute. For people who don't know you, your title might throw some people off and that you're not like product marketing by title anymore, but your roots are very much PMM. And so I thought your career has been really interesting in that you've been at some just giants in the kind of SaaS space and done product marketing across that journey. Do you mind just giving like the flyover of sort of how you got to Clari and where you're at now with this GVP role?
Yeah, yeah. Also, GVP is weird because like no one knows what the G stands for. Even I don't really know. I think it's global, but or group or something, but it's higher than VP. It's one level above. Yeah, so career-wise, I don't know, man, where should I even start? I guess technical guy. I started in machine learning and data science before it was hot back in France in like the early 2000s, I guess.
Yeah.
Did some consulting, did some pre-sales. Moved from pre-sales and SE to PMM when I came to the States in 2012. And to this day, I still think that solution engineering and pre-sales is like the best school for almost anything, honestly, but like typically for a PMM, because you're already at that kind of intersection of like sales and product and technical and customer and prospect. So that's my background. And then I had a fairly like linear, I think, career progression. PMM IC at Salesforce, moved up the rank, became PMM lead for the product called Einstein, left there, became VP PMM at Talend back in 2019, I believe. Then went to Gong to own corporate and product marketing in 2021, I think, and then came to Clary a little over 2 years ago to own the full stack.
Sweet. So just to name something, if you're going to dog on yourself with that resume, I don't think I'm going to distrust any of that as sandbagging. You've had a really cool career. Now, I would love to talk categories.
Thanks.
So I've been following what you've been up to at Clary for a while. And as far as I know this, you could tell me if this has evolved. Clary has tried to own this category of the revenue platform. And
right.
I would be curious, when you came to Clary, what was the landscape on that category? Like, were there other people trying to gun for that? Was that language already out in the environment? And then what made you decide, hey, this is the category we really want to own?
Yeah, good questions. I will start by saying, I would say category creation by Clary has been done kind of twice. Like, they started that with RevOps and even forecasting. And that's way before my time, right?
Yeah.
I believe that they kind of nailed that thing. Like, they, it's not like Clary invented RevOps, but they kind of like became the de facto go-to RevOps platform for people who want to run a better revenue process, a better forecasting cadence, and all of that stuff. And that was really the inception of the company, I believe, I don't know, 15 or something. So way before my time. So they did that. And then in 2022, the whole market was starting to consolidate. Salesforce would do its thing. Gong would start doing forecasting. Clary was interested in, you know, approaching the conversation intelligence platform. And it's just a lot of like market consolidation and like vendors kind of doing the same, claiming the same things. And so the idea was to play bigger.
Yeah.
You know, pun intended on the book name, and really to like rise above everybody else. Because when you're a revenue platform, you're like encompassing of all kind of the sub platforms. You know, you have a revenue execution platform out there. Not going to name the competitors. You have a revenue intelligence platform. You have a revenue blah platform. We're the revenue platform. So the idea was create the category to elevate ourselves, be perceived as the only really truly unified kind of platform vendor. And that helps us really differentiate and just win bigger deals faster. It's been a good move.
Yeah, that arc makes sense, that if you were kind of trying to claim that and popularize the idea of RevOps a number of years back, and you're building some of the early seeds of the category, that as you attach on more products in the suite to move from RevOps to just revenue at a broader level, I'd be curious, and I was going to talk acquisition later, but now I want to talk about it now. I'm curious in terms of a chicken or the egg, did Clary see this opportunity to go after the revenue platform and therefore started acquiring, or was it more seeing, hey, if we start acquiring, like take Wingman, for example, and we acquire Wingman, that's going to actually open us up to claim this new position. I'm curious, like, was positioning first or the acquisition opportunity first there with, like, we'll pick on Wingman.
It was the former. Wingman or Groove are good examples, right? We acquired Wingman right before I joined. I believe it was in July or June 2022, and Groove was last summer, August 2023. Yeah, it was. I would say it was. I wish positioning drove M&A strategy. I think it was more M&A strategy that kind of drove the category, kind of like playbook and creation. And so when you think about it, it makes sense, right? Because like RevOps is a super high, like high growth kind of persona and market. There's tons of studies, like the LinkedIn job study, whatever. I forgot the names of those, all those things. It's blowing up. It's one of the fastest growing kind of like job titles in America, at least. But still, it's one persona. So if you want to be truly a revenue platform, you have to cater to the needs and the use cases of the VP of sales, the CRO, if you have a CRO, maybe even the CCO, the frontline manager, the AEs, the AMs, the maybe even the SDRs, and of course the RevOps people, the leader and the practitioners. So I think the idea was, okay, let's just like go and address more use cases, bring more value to just more personae. I think that's how you say in English.
Personas.
I don't know. I don't speak English, man. Anyhow, so by bringing more value and addressing more use cases, you just end up playing bigger, and then you need that higher level narrative to support all the new product portfolio.
Yeah, that's always such an interesting challenge. And I'm feeling this in that. So my last company was primarily we'll call it a 1.5 product company. So like they really had one main product. And so positioning and narrative in my mind is actually quite easy when you have one product. And now I'm in a company that's got 8-10 products. And so
10 products, that's a lot.
Yeah, I would be curious how you're thinking through, best way to ask this. The risk I see is that when you try to craft a narrative for a suite of products, that narrative sometimes loses its teeth. Like it just doesn't feel as, you run the risk of becoming a little bit bland because you can't focus on one specific problem and get very specific with it. You have to kind of go broad. And so I would be curious, you've done a really good job at picking a problem and then owning that problem just for a couple years now. Do you know which problem I'm thinking of? The one you guys kind of named and owned?
I think I do. I hope some of the audience people do as well. Revenue leak.
Revenue leak. Yes, that's exactly it. Yeah.
Yes.
So you guys created this problem and have sort of owned it. It is. It's great. So I'd be curious, thinking about this, you've made this move from maybe kind of one or two products, multiple products to a platform. How did you go about crafting that specific narrative of identifying revenue leak as this kind of through line that goes across all those personas? We'll start there. How did you land on that narrative?
So revenue leak was invented. I can't take credit for it. I would say me and my team have perfected it and brought it to life and embedded that in the current narrative and sub storylines and whatnot, but it's not my invention. It was here just created before I joined back, as I said, July 2022. I think so. The thought process, I'm guessing how I would have done it, would have been like, okay, we have all these, we want to move away from just being a forecasting app. And we have now a multi-product platform, as you said. We address, say, 6 different use cases: prospecting, forecasting, deal inspection, account inspection, conversation intelligence, which can then be broken down into more use cases, blah, blah, blah. So we knew that we wanted that higher level, like villain, that would encapsulate all these use cases, right? And I think that's the beauty of coming up with your own language about the way to describe the enemy. The villain, it's then you can make it your own and you can define what that is. And if you have like something like revenue leak, then that first, that's shocking and disgusting, a little yucky, and like gives people pause and they want to know what is revenue leak. And then you can hit them with the right definition and tell them, think about your own funnel. Certain leads are not touched. Your pipe gen programs are not working. Your conversion through the pipeline is also you know, letting revenue leak. And the stuff happening when you move down the pipeline that, you know, gets in the way of closing more business and more revenue. So then people are like, oh, yeah, I see. So there's like sources of revenue leak, the leaky bucket. And then you can kind of like tell them, well, we have a solution for a revenue leak at the top of the funnel. We have a solution for revenue leak bottom funnel, you know, middle funnel and all of that stuff. So I think the secret here is coming up with a new problem that people might not be fully aware of, and then you can define it in a way that supports your product portfolio and the use cases that ultimately you end up addressing.
Yeah. Something I was just realizing as you're walking through that is that it's a problem narrative that has a metaphor at its heart. Even just this idea of leak, like, is very much a metaphor of this like leaky bucket. And I feel like in SaaS, you don't often see people making metaphor jumps. It's just like, it's very like cut and dry. So I appreciate that narrative element of like actually employing a metaphor and letting that be up like your main message to kind of articulate the problem across the board.
Agreed. Yeah. It's risky though, right? Not everybody can do it. Not everybody should do it. I think I remember at the beginning, our sales reps were like, revenue leak? What is that? It's not the problem that my customer comes to me with. Like, they want to do a better job at managing their pipeline. Like, why should I talk to them about revenue leak? And so there's then a bit of an enablement issue that you have to overcome to make the rep really understand that the whole idea of creating that bigger villain is that if there's demand coming from their customers and their, you know, named accounts coming to them about like, I need a better forecasting app, I need to better manage my pipe.
Yeah.
Then it's their job to say yes. And also there's other issues that we think you see in your pipeline today, like ABC, and people would be like, oh yeah, right. Then it'd be like, well, all the needs that you had in mind, plus these new needs that and problems that you were not even thinking about, that's revenue leak. So it's a way like, you know, the reps have to get really comfortable kind of like redirecting the demand in a way and not just playing by the rules of the customer, which can be a little counterintuitive, and try to like elevate the problem to something bigger. And that's how you end up going from you sell an app that would answer these two things to like a big platform that answers a massive issue like revenue leak.
That's a super helpful takeaway for me, because I've just been thinking through, we'll have people come to us for one problem. In our case, it's like, hey, we want fundraising, or we want donation forms that are more optimized and have less friction to complete a donation. Like that might be like the main problem. Or like, hey, we're having issues with branding consistency across our campaign pages, and we want something like,
right.
But I think I like that idea of trying to see, and well, the reason that wouldn't set you up for success is you probably don't just want to sell the one part of your product. You want to sell a platform if you're on a platform company. And so find that narrative that ties together all of these different areas of the product and unites them under one problem, I find super, super helpful.
Yeah, that's what category creators and designers call damn the demand. Like, it has a word, right? Damn the demand. Yeah. And that's what we're doing. But again, it comes with an enablement price. As I said, it's not for the faint of heart. It takes more time. It takes a little bit of like a mind shift for the reps to really be able to damn and redirect that demand and create that bigger order problem that the customers haven't even thought about. Like, it just takes a little more sales training and maybe even a little more time educating the buyer. But it pays off, because that investment that you make upfront is just going to land. It's going to help you land just bigger deals, truly multi-product, multi-year enterprise deals.
Yeah. To ask a brass tacks question, thinking about the actual pitch deck, is there some decent real estate in that pitch deck that is dedicated just to that uniting problem? Or
100%. Yes. Okay. Absolutely. We actually spend more time in problem land than in solution land. Our pitch deck is very much problem solution, right?
This, yeah.
At least like the Salesforce way. I come from Salesforce, right? There's like five different templates to like build a pitch deck. The most common one is problem solution. That's the one we chose here at Clary as well. But like I would say if, say the deck is, I'm going to make that up, 20 slides or something.
Yeah.
And you know, there's always like social proof slides and stuff at the end that nobody ever reads, which is very sad. It's a different issue we can talk about. But like you say you have 20 slides, we probably spend like 12 slides on problem and then the rest on solution. So we go really deep into problem. And that's also just a good way for the rep to like pause, shut up, and do a little bit of like discovery, right? Like, does that resonate with you? Can you walk me through examples of leaks at the top of your funnel? And then they take note and then it becomes like a true dialogue. I think if you spend enough time in problem land, you just, it just sets you up for a more natural discovery and discussion. Yeah.
That's super helpful. I'm in the middle of building a deck right now for a new segment in market that we want to go after, more accurately, a new market we want to go after. And I was noticing like, oh, my deck is 20 slides and about 10 of them are problem. And I was like, is this overkill? Mm-hmm. Like I had this natural question of like, is this too much on this problem narrative? So I'm just going to use that as your blessing.
I would say no. Yeah, you have my blessing, but it's just the data point of one French guy who doesn't speak English. So there's that. Like at the end of the day, it all depends on like the comfort level of your CRO and your reps, right? Because like if you have the most perfect, like should I say pitch perfect pitch deck type thing, like but nobody uses it because the salesmanship isn't here and they still want to, they're in a more transactional type of thing and they want to go to your solution and to demo as soon as possible. Sure. Then if that's the case, like your problem section is never going to get used. And as such, your deck, even if it's great, is going to be useless. So there's a bit of like company culture, salesmanship, sales training, enablement type and buyer stuff that, you know, you have to take into consideration. Like every pitch deck depends on the reps and the market.
Yeah. Super helpful. Now, something I've noticed in the last couple of months is this new thread sort of emerge in Clary's positioning. And it's that Clary is the first platform to cross $4 trillion of revenue under management. It's been in your social. Yeah. I saw Andy, your CEO, posting about it. It had places in your hero. I don't know if it still does, but it did. And obviously, super impressive claim. And in some ways, it speaks for itself. But I would be curious about some of your thinking on what motivated Clary to say, we're going to lead with that piece of social proof as really like, I mean, a really formative piece of positioning at that point to like put it top of funnel like that. So I'd be curious, like, could you give us a little bit of your thinking on why lead with that? Why at this time? That sort of thing.
100%. Yeah. Something that I'm really proud of. I think it was a bold move because, as you said, like typically back to what we just said, right? Like customer evidence, social proof, value points, that type of stuff gets typically buried in the second half of your deck or like down your page, and no one actually ever reads those value stats. Because, you know, like oh yeah, cool, 30% improvement in win rates. Like, the fuck does that mean? Sorry, what does that mean? So like, it's like that people don't, you can beat me on this one. People don't read the value stats. And so it was a bit of a bold move of like, okay, we're going to put that up in front and center. So why we did that is the idea was, the thesis rather was, by like showing that we achieved a certain milestone and then amplify that on social and in the market would just help us grow our credibility and shape the perception that we have won the category, right? So it's not new messaging. It's not new positioning. It's not a new POV. Yeah. It's a way for us to, you know, get instant credibility when it comes to still delivering our existing POV. POV being you have a bigger problem. It's called revenue leak and you need a revenue platform to solve for it and spot and stop the leaks, right? Yeah. So the POV hasn't changed. We just use that thing to like grab people's attention. And then I think what's cool about it is that there's a lot of like subliminal messages, if you will, that kind of go with that stat, right? Like when you, so the announcement was, well, the first RevTech vendor to cross $4 trillion of revenue under management. The first thing that comes to you, if you don't know any of the market, is what is this? What is revenue under management? And so then it's good because you start like, you again, you hook people with a question, right? It's like revenue leak in a way. So people start like, they want to keep reading because they want to know more about that new metric. And then the other subliminal messages is because we've had so much data flowing through the platform, we have captured some of that data, which gives us a really big kind of data advantage, which then trains AI models. And then out of AI, you get a lot of value and a lot of outcomes. And the other subliminal message is also, while we've acquired a lot of expertise, like a lot of these big companies, enterprise logos would be using Clary, which is the case, to kind of run their revenue processes. And as such, Clary also has a lot of revenue expertise. So I liked that bet, if that makes sense, because I think it was a little unconventional. And it was a way for us to continue to deliver our market POV and in subliminal ways allude to the fact that we have a lot of data, a really good AI, and a lot of expertise.
Yeah. That number is so massive that, it comes with all these assumptions that you can make of like anyone who's managing that much revenue, they've got to have, I bet their data stack is incredible. I bet they have these enterprise, they can support enterprise companies. I bet they can support a small company too. Like you just, you start having all of these assumptions, which I mean, to where we started, if you're going to make, put a stake in the ground on a, what I would say is a broad position of the revenue platform. You need to have some, like some teeth to back that up. Like you need something that's really going to bolster that. So it makes sense to elevate that piece of proof to the top.
That's right. Yeah. And I would say it went beyond just the announcements, right? Because like at the end of the day, we also like, this is, you know, like what's in it for me would ask a more skeptical like person and audience. Well, we had a really well packaged deck around all the learnings that we've had through that process of managing so much revenue and so much data, right? And so the give, it's always give and get type thing. So the give part was a good deck with, I think we had like five or six learnings that were really non-obvious. People would read that and I do think it was insightful and informative for people. So 4 trillion was the hook. People ask you, okay, why, where does that matter? And then they get to, they continue to read and then they're like, what's in it for me? And bam, that's where we hit them with a really nice CTA, which is a learning stack that they can take home and apply to their, you know, life.
Sweet. Day. I like translating social proof into this kind of takeaway asset like that. I feel like you don't see that a lot. Like you'll see a case study of here's how client X gained X, like Y revenue with platform Z, like, and that's it.
Yeah.
But to take something that's broader like that and comes from a breadth of customers and then say, this is some takeaways that we have that probably no one else does. Here's some actual content that you can take for free. And I imagine the ways that translated to pipe were super helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So
glad you liked it.
I did. So we've talked about Clary from in what you've built there so far. But something I think I'd be remiss on is if we didn't talk about your team. So something that I know you're passionate about and something you've done is you've built out a really killer product marketing team at Clary the last few years. Shout out to Emily Pick, friend of mine, who's joined your team.
Emily, she's wonderful.
Yeah, she's so good. Now, something I've heard you talk about before is the way that you choose to structure your PMM team. And there are a lot of theories on how a team should be structured. But if I remember correctly, yours was actually quite unique and you were taking some personal elements into account, which I thought was really, really unique. So can you walk us through how you've chosen to structure Clary's product marketing team?
Yeah, 100%. I would say the way what we chose might not apply to you if you think about restructuring your team, right? Like every company is different. But I think ultimately the main dimension to consider is, are you a product-led company or are you a sales-led company? And probably you're going to be a little bit of both, right? Yeah. What's the culture? Do you have a single product? Do you have multi-products? Do you have multiple segments and whatnot? So we had all these questions in mind. That typically in the industry, what you see is a PMM team aligned either by product line or by function, right? So if you have a multi-product offering, then say you have five products, you have five PMMs, bam, that's it, one-to-one mapping, or maybe it can be a one-to-two mapping, whatever, like aligned by product. The other thing is would be aligned by function. One PMM owns messaging and positioning. One PMM owns launch. One PMM owns enablement and compete and, you know, all of those things. So what I don't like in each of these is that you don't play with the people's strength or you don't go deep into product, right? And I kind of want, PMM is so unique as a discipline, as a function, because it requires people to be able to go deep into market, customer, and product understanding and knowledge.
Yeah.
But also you need to flex your muscles and go a little broad. You see what I'm doing? I'm doing this when I
flex my muscles. You can't see, Julian is just looking very muscular on camera.
The French muscles. And so all of that is to say, I'm blushing now. All of that is to say that what we did is, and we did that at Gong as well, and even at Salesforce, is kind of that hybrid model of like, you have a product. Every PMM has a product mapped to their function, to their job. I mean, it's mapped to a product, but also they have a function minor, for example, right? So, say Emily would be aligned to Groove. That's the product line, and also she's aligned to all the voice of the customer type of programs, market intel, research. She's doing some analyst stuff and whatnot. So that's the way we kind of structured the team. Aligned both by product and function. That way people can go deep into product and market, but they can also go broad and own, you know, certain functions and really play with their strengths.
Now, that's super helful to lay out. I like that accommodation for both the product, one PMM to one product, and trying to have that minor. I really like that language of like you major on this product and you minor in a specialty of some sort. Yeah, precisely because of what you've named, is sometimes there just isn't room for the fact that someone might be far and away your best messaging person on your team, but they're stuck messaging just this one product or whatever skill you want to translate that to. I'd be curious practically then. So like, let's take a hypothetical situation. Say, say Emily's got a launch for Groove. I'm imagining that she is primarily owning that launch. But then is there someone else that she is, say if you had another PMM whose messaging is their thing, is the minor more of where you consult on what another PMM is up to? Is that how that like practically plays out? Is like she might own Groove, but she'll consult with the PMM who messaging is their thing or storytelling is their thing?
Absolutely. Yeah. So one thing before I get into more details on this, I do believe that messaging and positioning is like, if you're not good at it, then you should not be in PMM, right? Like there's no work around that thing. It's just, it comes with the job. But like, let's say Emily doesn't own analyst relations, for example. But yet for that one Groove launch, she would really be the owner of the launch program. But then when it comes to like, you know, doing pre-briefing with Gartner and Forrester, then she would go talk to the PMM who owns AR to kind of work with them on the briefing deck. And maybe she would be the one delivering the message to the analyst, or maybe the other person would. So that's a good example of like, because you own like a launch doesn't mean that you do all the things. It's that good old definition, that good old difference between like, you can not own something, but you still contribute to it. If you own something, you might not contribute to all the things. Otherwise, you just go crazy because it's too much work. But you go and tap into the existing resources and even the cross-functional people to get to the outcome that you expect from your program. So it's that difference of owning doesn't mean contributing and vice versa.
Yeah, I really like that. And then I imagine by contrast, if someone were launching a new feature or a product under Copilot and they wanted to know like, hey, how important is this to our customers? Like, is this something that we should tier as like a tier one launch because it's been requested and it's a cause for closed loss or whatever it may be, that they could then go to Emily and she could give like the pulse on customer voice, how the customer sentiment, that sort of thing.
That's right. That's exactly right. She's the one who owns the majority of the VOC channels, right? Like we use Winter, for example, Winter with a Y for message testing and survey and whatnot. We love the tool, the app. She owns a CAB, customer advisory board, from a content standpoint. So like, as you said, the Copilot PMM, which is not, it's somebody called Christine, who's also wonderful and fantastic, comes from Salesforce. Christine would be like, okay, I'm thinking about this. This is my launch plan. I need to do some testing before. Hey, Emily, can you help me get into these VOC channels and we're going to tag team together. I'm going to use your expertise so that I know how to do the thing and then get my VOC data in the right, you know, in the right format. So yeah, that's the way. It's not perfect. It never is. We all know PMM can be a little messy, but I think if you have that mapping by product and function really well documented, people start developing those expertise on the functional side or on the product side, and then it just becomes natural. Like Emily is the VOC PMM type of person. People just come to her, you know. So there's something to be said about you need to document how your team is mapped and structured, but then if it works, it just becomes natural and organic. People come to you because they know you're the SME at a given product or a given function.
Yeah. Yeah, that's super helpful. Well, I mean, first off, thank you for giving kind of a glimpse under the hood of all things Clary. It's super helpful just to see how someone who's kind of dominating a category thinks and how they've operated. I mentioned earlier that you've had a really impressive PMM career and you're one of my PMM heroes, just for what it's worth. So I would be curious, I didn't tell you I was going to ask you this, but if you could go back to the Julian who's just getting started in PMM or to someone else who's in those shoes where they're just getting started in their product marketing career, do you have one or maybe two pieces of advice that you either wish you heard, or if you could grab that Julian by the shoulders and say something to him, what would that be?
Oh man, I love that question. It's a tricky one. There's so many advice I would give to like mini Julian from 10 years ago when I didn't know what PMM meant and how to spell it. I would say find your balance between inbound and outbound. Maybe like I was a PMM for like 2 years or 1 year, I think rather, at a company that then got acquired by SAP. Did not like SAP. I went to Salesforce. So I could say that the PMM, the school of PMM for me was Salesforce, at least back in those years, 2015, 2018 kind of period. And Salesforce is fantastic company. They really put PMM on the map. They developed a great playbook. It's very outbound type stuff. Like PMM at Salesforce means you do messaging and positioning, you build decks, you write keynotes, you go up on stage, you present. Like it's very, very outbound. The inbound aspect of PMM is very underdeveloped at Salesforce for reasons that I'm happy to discuss at some point. So they don't do a lot of testing. They don't really do a lot of influencing the roadmap. They don't do as much compete type stuff. There's other teams to do that. I guess that's why, right? So all the more inbound aspect of PMM was very underdeveloped at Salesforce. And now after all these years, I wish I knew that. I wish I knew that there was an inbound aspect to PMM. And I think I would have done a better job on certain projects by knowing that, testing more, caring about enablement and thinking about PMs and whatnot. So I think what you can don't take for granted that the function as defined as it is at your company is what it should be. I think that would be my advice. Think broader, talk to your peers, network, and make the function yours. It doesn't have, PMM doesn't have to be what your employer believes it is. It should be what you think it should be.
That's super good. Thank you. And just even for people who aren't familiar, I think that framework of outbound, inbound PMM is super helpful. Yeah. If you haven't heard it, the short of it is outbound is a lot of the, what we think outwardly facing work of a product marketer of launch and messaging, top of funnel, inbound being much more of this research data oriented side of PMM. But I love that vision of not accepting what PMM has been at a company and just said, this is what it is, but instead trying to architect what you want your career to look like and what you want your world to look like.
Exactly. And also what the company needs, right? So sometimes what the job description says isn't exactly what the company needs. So it's on you, it's on all of us to deeply think through that and really see if there's not another thing that's not part of the current scope of your work that you should be owning. And if that's the case, you find that one thing, you lean in, you work extra hours for a few weeks or months, you show success and impact on that one additional thing that you now owned.
Yeah.
And that's growth. And that's how you get to the next level.
Yeah. Well, again, Julian, thank you. This was such a treat. I'm grateful both for your friendship and that you were willing to come on the show. If people want to keep up with you and what you're up to at Clary and just continue to learn from you, follow you, where can they find you? What's the best place for that?
Yeah, well, I think people in SF now know where to find me and maybe where to find you next time you're in town. Any good coffee shop, I will be there. I try to go to a different coffee shop at least once a week. But if you're not local or if you don't like coffee, which is completely fine, just LinkedIn. I would say LinkedIn is where I try to post every day, give some tips, make some jokes, talk about baguette. So LinkedIn is where you can
a lot of baguette content, which I love.
Yep. Baguette and coffee, man. It's a good combo. It's a good pairing.
There you go. All right. Well, thanks again, my friend. Appreciate it.
For everyone still tuned in, thanks so much for listening. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please help us spread the word to other product marketers. Thanks again and have a great morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are.